Hallito and welcome to Native Chalk Talk, a podcast by Natives for all. Here we're keeping our Native ancestors' stories and history alive, while also sharing with you our Native culture, traditions, and more. I'm Rachel Youngman, a Choctaw originally from Anadarko, Oklahoma. I hope you'll enjoy this journey with me as we learn from our Native American guests. And I hope you'll do me a favor. Feel free to like and share these episodes. I so appreciate it. Yakuki.
Did you know that Native Choctaw supports missing, murdered Indigenous women, Chutta? Simply go to cafepress.com/Native Choctaw Shop and you can find hoodies, sweatshirts, t-shirts, cups, all kinds of things. And a portion of proceeds goes to help the organization as well as the families and the victims. God bless.
Hallito, y'all, and welcome to part two of this fascinating conversation with Marine veteran and former tribal CEO Solomon Little Owl of the Crow Nation, who we learned in part one was a graduate of Northern Colorado University. He was later the honored recipient of the Alumni Award for his work in co-founding the Fighting Whites basketball team that raised over $150,000 in scholarships and for his organization of Buffalo Hunts. So welcome back, Solomon.
Hello, thank you for having me again, Rachel.
Absolutely. So I promised our listeners they'd get to hear about your ancestral stories and about your Crow tribe and history. So let's dive in, starting with your mother. What's the word for mother in Crow, by the way?
The word for mother is Ikea. Ikea.
Beautiful. So what's your mama's name and tell us about her?
My mother, Linda. Her main name is Stan Zilverbull. Stan Zilverbull was given to my my great great grandpa, who was a buffalo hunter, and he was one
That's
of
so
the
perfect.
Ones that, yeah, and he hunted buffalo for the tribe and everything, and that's why his crow name is in translation is Beshah Agenelush. I mean, and if you switch it to English, it's Zanzorabul. And so my mother's a mountain crow, from Pryor, Montana, and like I said, she was born and raised on a reservation, and she had maybe six siblings. One passed away a while back, and now she's, like I said, she's still on a reservation, and she's doing well. She's 84 years old, and she's the last of all of her siblings, so it's just kind of sad.
Aww, yeah.
To be the last sibling. I know it seems tough, but she's doing well. And like I said, with family, we have a big clan system still, and so the clan system is matriarch, and so we follow at birth we follow our mother's clan, and my mother's clan is Big Lodge, and so I'm a Big Lodge kid, and then the second clan is your dad's clan, and so my dad's clan, we go off of their second clan because my dad's second clan, the paternal clan, is Big Lodge kid. So I'm a Big Lodge on my mother's side, and I'm a Big Lodge kid on my dad's side, and my dad's River Crow.
Oh, okay.
So the clan system was made not to have intermarriages and stuff like that.
Okay.
And then. Half of the clans were Mountain Crow, and half of the other clans were River Crow. So I'm half River Crow and half Mountain Crow as well.
All the things. So Big Lodge, do you know where that word Big Lodge came from?
Yeah, it's Big Lodge is in the band. It's the biggest band it has, and it has the most teepees. So Big Lodge is It's not the size of it, it's the amount of teepees that's available. That's why it's called a Big Lodge.
I love that. And I wonder how many generations that
Yeah,
goes
and
back.
yeah, and yeah, and that and that's the like I said, that's the biggest clan since the Crows moved away from North Dakota. We had eight clans, but two were destroyed by smallpox, and so those clans never came about again. But our smallest clan is called Bad Wordies in Crow. It's called Ishkepkoya. Those are the clan that does things backwards, in a way.
Really?
Yeah,
What does
they
that
do
mean?
things kind of they do crazy stuff, like
Okay.
example, a bad wordy would make a fence and forget to put a gate, and they entrap themselves in their gate, things like that.
Oh, gotcha. So,
They
oh,
in
wow.
and they're not, and they're not supposed to speak to their wives, their wives' mother or their aunts, and sometimes bad wordies people do that. So
Really?
yeah, so there's a lot, so there's a lot of, like I said, there's a lot of tribal things that we still follow, our custom stuff.
Yeah. I
And
love to see that. So much has been lost with so many tribes.
so that's my mother's side.
And then her father, so your grandfather, what was his
Yes.
name, and what else can you tell us about him?
Elkin is his name, and Stansoverbull. He's the only kid, and he married my grandmother. Her name was Goldie Duss. That was her last name. And so Elkin, I never knew Elkin's mom. Because he was raised by his uncles, so I'm not sure
Okay.
what really happened to his dad and his mother. So I don't, like I said, there's so many diseases at the time.
Sure.
Polio was pretty big back then, and then some of the remnants of smallpox was still around, I believe. And so I never knew his grand. His parents, but like I said, I never knew my grandpa either, because he passed away when my mom was pretty young, and I never had
Oh.
a chance to meet my grandma on my dad's side either, because she came down with a pneumonia and she passed away.
Oh.
So like I said, but I knew my grandpa on my dad's side, and I knew my grandma on my mom's side.
Okay. I love the
So
grandparents.
elk yeah. So Elkin was a great hunter, like his grandpa, and then or his dad and his grandpa. My grandma has an old crow dress, and back then, those elk teeth that the crows use were real elk teeth. That crows, when they harvest an elk, they'll get the teeth from the back part of the jaw, and that's what
Amazing.
it's used for the elk teeth now. Everything's boned, so they just go out and I can't remember some of those places where they sell bone elk tooth, and that even them for like 10 or 20, they're like $50 now. But for a real
Wow.
elk tooth necklace, it goes about $400 now.
That's
And
amazing.
so,
Is
yeah, I mean, that
that
talk about
dress still?
in No, I don't know what happened to that dress. I think she lost it or gave it away or something. But it's almost like four times as heavy than a regular elk tooth dress.
I bet.
But that was, but that was their like gala dress, I would say, if you want to take kind of give an example that way. It'll be
Yeah.
like a really,
Fancy
really nice
dress.
dress. Yeah.
Yeah. With all those
So
elk
there was
teeth
a
on
that
it.
was her special, but like I think there was maybe 400 sets on that dress, and all that was killed by my grandpa.
That's
So it
amazing. I
kind of,
mean, what a special dress. Can you imagine? It's like, yeah,
Oh
this is my
man,
dress, and he killed the elk, and that's all its teeth. Amazing.
even if I killed 10 elk, a year, I still won't be able to, I think, catch up to that amount of
right.
to make my own or provide enough elk teeth for a dress, because it's so much, you know. And
so
I
much.
I just couldn't believe it, but yeah. Yeah,
and I can't imagine how heavy it was on her.
Yeah. And I said, I still have a picture of my grandpa, my grandpa Elkin and my grandma Goldie.
You'll share those with me, right?
Yeah, I'll share that with you. I'll send it to you.
Okay, cool. I'm dying to see that dress. And now you wonder, where is it? Did somebody have it? Is it in a museum? Like, where's the dress? Well, it's interesting that your father was a buffalo hunter and the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So as we discussed in part one about your organization and the buffalo hunts, now, like most of our ancestors, the government and missionaries typically required Native Americans to take on a surname, typically a name that was easier for English speaking people to pronounce. Same for your family, right?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. When like the early 1900s, the missionaries from Mormonism to Catholics to Jehovah Witnesses, they all showed up at one time. And so a lot of the translations were that the names translation names came from the Bible.
Yeah.
But those translation names was their last names, and then they translated their names to the first names.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah. Sorry. They gave them Bible names, but then they took their names and made them last names. Sorry.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah.
So example, my great grandpa, his crow name is Pobedigadish. And that Pobedigadish became his last name, which is Littlewell. And so they gave him like John or something like that.
It goes from this really cool name, this, you know, probably historic name, to John.
Yeah, John.
Yeah. Oh, we'll call you John.
Yeah. So my crow name, like I said, every crow has a crow name. And so my crow name is Bagalachewa Chajish, which means in translation in English, it's having great faith.
Oh.
So yeah, so that was given to me by a clan mother or a clan aunt, I would say. So it was an older lady who is Big Lodge. She's the one that gave me that name.
So how does that typically work? Someone giving you a name, is there a certain age, or how does that work?
No, yeah, a lot of times you want somebody to grow up with a, like for example, you want to give them a crow name, you want to grow up with it.
Mm.
But it takes like I said, it takes a couple months. You just kind of see that kid's character or what they're like, and then out of the blue, people that kind of have a family history of example of using bears or using buffaloes, because some of the cool stories, and so that are fighting the enemy and stuff like that. So they usually have those kind of things, and so so example, my dad, he has a lot of family stories about bears, and so his crow name was Dachbachach Lachesh. And then later on, as he became a prominent member of the crow tribe, he some of his clan brothers gave him the name Dechgash Ijilesh. Dechgash is eagle, and Ijila is horse. So he's kind of like a Pegasus now.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Love that.
Dechgash Ijilesh. Yeah, that was the crow name was given to him about 10 years before he passed.
That's beautiful.
He got it from his, you know, growing up, and then he got another one. I can't remember what that middle one was, but he got his third crow name being an elder.
Interesting. I truly believe that when we talk about our ancestors and keep their memories and stories alive, that we're honoring them. So tell me more about your ancestors and their stories.
Well, like I said, my ancestors came from North Dakota. And when they our chief that brought us from North Dakota, his English name was Arapush, but in translation, Arapush is Elapush Roddenbilly. So people know him as Arapush, but we know him as Roddenbilly, Elapush. So he was the chief that brought us there, and then when they got to, I believe, somewhere around Bozeman area, that's when he had a dream of why we were put there, and his dream was to the west, you know, the tribes from the west, all they eat is fish, and then from the tribes to the north, it's too cold up there. And then to the tribes to the east, said the water is so bad that animals don't drink the water, the river. And then to the south of us, it's so hot that they grow vegetables that are too hot to eat. So that's what. So that was the vision he got, and he said the Creator put us here at this spot where it's the perfect spot on earth. So that was his vision, and that's how we came about being a Crow. And then that's how a lot of things, we became a tribe, and we also, couple other tribal chiefs. I can't remember his name. He's the one that, oh, sorry. I know his name. His Crow name is Oak Quinawajush, who sits in the middle of the land. And before they had the Fort Laramie Treaty, he became the chief, and his dream was he saw, and before teepees only had three posts to start with, I believe we're the only tribe that put up teepees that had four posts, and so the four posts represents the four sites, and in those everything in interior of those four post sites belong to the Crow tribe. And so when they went to Fort Laramie Treaty, that's what he let the interpreters know. He said, this is what I saw in my dream, and these four posts represent our lands, and everything in between, including the fish, belong to the Crow tribe. And so if you look at the old documents of the Fort Laramie Treaty, you can see the last Crow can hunt and fish on this land until they pass. Then after the Crows are gone, the treaty will be gone.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So that's how we that's how our reservation came about, was sits in the middle of the land. And then along the way, like I said, our reservation keeps getting smaller and smaller. But there was a lot of stories which, through oral history, we didn't know. I mean, well, we knew, but we didn't know what event caused them. And so, and just recently, probably in the last 3 years, I've been doing research through the National Archives since the Fort Laramie Treaty. And I'm starting to make sense of why those stories were said, the oral histories, and you can see what the government was doing to the tribe, or some of the events that were happening. Well, was more with the pandemics of the smallpox and the bird flu. I mean, sorry, not bird flu, but pneumonia, and yeah. I can't remember what the. So there's like three to four epidemics that were happening since the establishment of the reservation. And so I'm like I said, I'm still doing the research on the government's portion what they were doing and how they were tearing, well, on what they were doing to destroy the reservation and its people. So I'm starting to see all that now. And so the stories that we hear orally still, they're starting to make sense now on why they were being done. And like I said, I still need to know more about those stories and why they were told and why they, right. I mean, why we still hear those oral stories. And so people can see now, and I have the evidence from the government side, why the Crow did what they had to do to survive. So,
yes.
So it's kind of a sad situation. And, but like I said, they always looked at the Crow as, I'm sure they looked at other tribes as being illiterate. Because, you know, that writing in the English language and everything else was foreign to this country. And so
exactly.
Now we got to at least catch up. Yeah, you know, catch up or be better. And so that was the Crow. And like I said, we have our Crow Fair every year, third weekend in August. We call it the TB Capital of the World. And one year, I think we had somewhere around 2,500 teepees.
Whoa, that's
and
amazing.
So, yeah.
I would love to see that.
If you like Indian food or Native American food, a lot of them are there. I think my favorite delicacy is kidney on a stick. Very, very good.
Delicious. I would try it.
Yeah, very good. And then like I said, we for this Crow Fair, we have a new arbor. 20,000, or I believe they said it was a $20 million project. It's completed, and it's probably the biggest outdoor arbor in some of the plains areas. And it's powwow time. You go and dance, so you can be a real cowboy Indian during Crow Fair.
Real cowboy Indian.
So yeah.
Are you? Do you dance?
Yes, I do dance. Crocodile, it's more of our own dance. That's where the crow hop comes from. I don't know if you know the crow hop.
Crow hop
is kind of like the main dance.
Okay.
Universal dance. So it originated from the crow tribe. And the way we dress is where we have bells that go around our waist. We have bells that go around our down our legs, and then we have bells on our ankles. So if you hear a really loud, like if it sounds like Santa Claus coming down the street, it's a crow and his bells.
It's a crow.
Yeah, you can't
crow
miss
with
them.
Bells on.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of like the crow outfit, and then we have the busso, we have the roach, and ours is it's very similar to a chicken dance.
Okay.
But a lot of the chicken dancers don't wear bells though.
Ah.
But we wear bells, and then we kind of dance similar to the chicken dance. But we have seven dances. The first crow dance is very popular now, and it's probably done at every powwow now. It's got the crow hop, where men and women and children dance, and it's a very competitive. It's actually a dance contest. Song, or dance, and it's and a lot of people love to watch the crow hop, and so a lot of the other tribes do it, but more the traditional dance. We have the bear dance, and we have the war dance. Those two are very traditional. So the one I dance with is the war dance, which is kind of one style. Just kind of slow dance, because if you haven't danced before, man, you know, it's really hard to dance in moccasins and
all the regalia, and the bells.
Yeah. When you're not in shape, you know, it's really tough to dance.
You're like,
so,
but anyway, I'll do the warrior
dance. That's what I do. Yeah. I wear a roach. Roach is kind of, they're real easy. And like I said, the roaches, you need to have long hair. braided hair or something. If not, you have to wear a wig that has braids. And that way you can tie them in, and then you can tie your brooch to your wig. And but yet you're supposed to have long hair. And so, but for me to have short hair, I have to have a wig with long braids. So I kind of look real different. Crow Fair, man, it's like a big family reunion. And then at the end of Crow Fair, our special dance is called the parade dance. And so the parade dance, it's you pick four young people within the tribe, and you have them be the four leaders. And so each person represent, or out of the four, each person represents a season. And like I said, we have four seasons on the reservation. So each one, they pray and they give out tobacco, and then they dance, and then they usually sing a song, remembrance of the family. Each family has a song, so you know, you get to hear family songs and stuff. But yeah, it's so yeah, when all the visitors leave Crow Fair, our powwow starts, which is the parade dance. Yeah, and that's the start of the new year for us too. So we have three New Years.
Three.
New Year's on the calendar, and the Crow New Year's, and then the Spring New Year's too.
The Spring New Year's, okay.
Yeah, when the first thunder goes off, that's the New Year. That's when all the animals and all the insects wake up.
I love that. So the Crow are also known as another name, which is what?
Apsalaga.
Apsalaga.
Apsalaga is Apsalaga with a P. Well, some people go with the P, and some people go with the B.
Okay.
I go with the B myself.
Mm-hmm.
Apsalaga.
What does Apsalaga mean?
Well, Apsalaga is the name given to us by the Hidatsa, mm-hmm. which is the long-beaked bird.
Mm.
And the long-beaked bird was a raven. And then when Lewis and Clark showed up, they didn't know how to say it, but all they knew was how to say crow. So that's when we became a crow. That's what Lewis and Clark, you know, all that happened. So instead of Apsalaga, like I said, they put us in crow, just like the Dene people. You know, the Spanish people gave him that Navajo, which is a thief, translation. And so, yeah. So, like I said, I think all tribes have, some kind of name that goes with them from neighbors, you know, different neighbors and tribes and stuff. So, but one of the things that we're working on as a project in the near future is, we're trying to implement historical stories about tribes that live near water, so that way we can hear the stories of different tribes and what their neighbors call them. So example, you know, we call ourselves Apsalaga, but other tribes give us a different name, you know. And then like for us, we have names for all kinds of different tribes, like for example, Cheyenne. We call Cheyennes Azashbusha. Azashbusha is Cheyenne. But because of the old Crow and the new Crow, we kind of took a shortcut. And so it's supposed to be Azasha Pusha. It means their blankets are kind of poofy. So it was the way
That's great.
Yeah, it's the way they put their blankets, or the way they got their blankets, and the way they placed them.
Aww. Wow.
And then like Ashoka, like flathead. Flathead is the way they cut their hair. They cut their hair very short on top. and we call them Ashokaba, which is the flathead. Piagala, it's the way they make their stew, which is the flat, or the black bean people.
Okay. Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah, so
I never thought about that, different tribes would call each other different things. So there's what the tribe called themselves, and then there's what the other tribes may have called them too.
Yeah. Yeah.
You really opened my eyes on that. I never thought about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're trying to work on a project that works on the Missouri River.
Mm-hmm.
And so hopefully we can get more stories and get bring the tribes together again.
In your family, do you speak Crow to each other?
Crow's our primary language.
That's amazing.
And it's our first language too. So we grew up talking Crow.
Who would have thought?
And so, yeah, and like I said, you know, the day when all the tribes find their languages and their culture back, and I think that's when all the healing will begin. And
true.
And then all the generations will be in a better place than we are.
We'll be back after this quick break. Are you looking for the perfect gift for your significant other, your bestie, or even yourself? You know you're worth it. Luxury soaps, lotions, and lip balms from Baker's Bar Soapery are 100% Choctaw crafted, and they make the perfect gifts. This work of art is their signature turquoise soap, and it's made to look like Sleeping Beauty turquoise. Do you see this gold veining throughout? And the gold marbling on top? Love it. Next, check out this Apple Mint custom fragrance oil soap called Say Their Name. And all proceeds go to the Missing Murdered Indigenous Women Choctaw cause. You'll only find this blend made specifically for this soap. And yes, these are made with goat's milk, which leaves your skin feeling soft and supple. So load up on these Choctaw soaps made by Tiffany at Baker's Bar Soapery at thebbsoapery.com. But be sure to get 20% off when you use the code NATIVECHOCKTALK, that's all caps, when you spend $25 or more. Treat yourself to the luxury your skin deserves with Baker's Bar Soapery.
Yeah, it's a wake-up call for us as a nation that we're losing our language. But like I said, before, like the old Crow, where my grandpa spoke, he would talk to me in Crow, and I didn't even know some of those words. I never heard of those words. And I
was, right.
Oh, okay. But he spoke more of the shortcut Crow words, then I would know.
Oh, yeah.
And so, like, yeah, and we still like prior example, prior, the town is called Uwada Ashish. That means Arrow Creek. Uwada is arrow, and so creek is Asha. So Uwada Asha, Arrow Creek. And so a lot of the Crows still name that town. They don't use Pryor, because Pryor was actually
really
a member of Lewis and Clark. Take for instance Valley of the Chiefs, which is Lodgegrass. Valley of the Chiefs, why it's in Crow, is called Ashbajecha. Ashbajecha is the creek of many chiefs, and that's where, in translation, it's called Valley of the Chiefs. So it's stuff like that. So, like,
right,
every town has its own Crow name, which just kind of reflects the culture.
Yeah. Too. Correct me if I'm wrong. I was reading that 7,900 of the 11,000 Crows enrolled in tribal membership live on the Crow Reservation, and that's a large amount of your population that actually live on the reservation.
I would say maybe half now.
Okay.
Maybe have, yeah. The reason why I say have is when I was the CEO, I had a chance to see all the per capita payments that were off the reservation versus on reservation, and it was almost very similar.
And okay.
So when we get our per cap, you know, we usually get it. In Crow, it's called a wewisha, and it's like, but it's all the monies from our co,
yeah,
our coal mine that gives us that money, and so it's distributed equally amongst all the members, enrolled members of the tribe. So we get an annual per cap of in August, December, and April.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, it used to range from like $300, $400, and then in the 80s it was really bad, and it got down to like $20, $19, and
oh,
stuff
man.
like that. So now it's gone back up to about maybe $200 each three times out of the year. It's not a lot, but man, the crows love it though.
Right. Well, it feels like
Yeah.
Something that's created by the crows for the crows, probably.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said, a lot of people argue, but it was my uncle, Patrick Stanzover Bull, was the chairman when all the per cap payments were established to help Crow people. He was the one
Mm-hmm.
that, he was one of the people that established it.
Really?
And so, and he was also the one that established the mine itself too, Westmoreland Mine.
Okay. Wow, what
So
a
yeah, we
legacy
have a
your
lot of
family
coal.
has.
Yeah. Thank you.
Where is the reservation in Montana?
It's southeastern part. It
okay.
It boundaries the northeastern part of Wyoming. So it's
Okay.
between Billings, Montana, and then Sheridan, Wyoming.
Okay. And is it true that the reservation consists of 2.3 million acres? Is that about right?
Yes, I say it's a little bit more now, because
Okay.
of certain things that have happened.
Yeah.
And then, like I said, unfortunately, the very few, maybe 100,000, maybe that much land has come back to the reservation. I mean, that's tribally owned. But now, because of the land buybacks and stuff that happened, three of them have already taken place. Before, it was almost like maybe 50-50 landowners to 50% tribal owned. But now that land buyback went up to maybe 20% trust landowners now to 80% tribally owned. But if you look at the policies, it's a way to destroy the reservation still. That's the way I interpret everything.
I gotcha.
All the policies that are for to destroy the reservation are still in place. Nothing's changed. Now it's easier for the government to get rid of the tribe. Once that happens, then individual landowners won't have that right anymore.
Right.
Keep their land because of trust land.
Interesting. Yeah, Oklahoma for the longest time has been trust land, and now it's going back to reservations.
Yeah.
But different than some reservations, very different. So do non-natives or let's say non-Crow people, do they come on the reservation, or is it
Oh yeah.
pretty
Yeah,
much blocked?
About 45% of the land about 45% of all the lands on the reservation are fee lands now, which are owned by non-tribal members, which kind of messes up a lot of things.
Gotcha.
And like I said, one of the policies that was created to destroy the reservation was, as a Crow member, you have to own land to buy land on a reservation. But if a non-Crow member from the outside comes in, they can buy as much land as possible if they want to.
Really?
But even me, so right now I can buy any land off the reservation, but I can't buy any land on a reservation because I don't have any land.
Okay.
Mom and dad, they both have land. A lot of my family members had land, but now they sold them because of the land buyback. Which is a
interesting
whole new can of worms that was open.
Where the reservation is, are those originally the Crow's historical homelands?
Yes. Right now, like I said, we're with Cheyennes, Lakota, their Northern Arapaho, Blackfeet, the Assiniboine. Rocky Boy. We all kind of fought over the same lands and stuff. And so when Fort Laramie Treaty started, you know, our chief Sitsimmel's land was the one that really put down the boundaries. But then some of those boundaries really kind of mixed in with the different claims as well.
Yeah.
But if you go into the archives and you see all the old maps, you know, and I'm pretty sure Oklahoma tribes, their national archives are in Fort Worth.
Mm-hmm.
And one of these days, one of the things we want to do is have classes on for tribes to come and review the historical archives that are in these different areas to see what the government has done, which is written. It's evidence of what they were trying to do and how they did it. So that way they can see all the injustices the government did. That way they can at least have something to go off of. You know, if you don't understand the past,
exactly,
you're not going to understand the future. And so the future and the past has a combination of both ways to live in the present and then to move forward there. And so, hopefully we can get some kind of class going in the new future. You know, maybe within a year to 2 years, we can help tribes do studies on their own archives.
I think that is fascinating, the idea of teaching people in a way that they can absorb pretty easily what that actually looks like. Because I also have a Native American friend who not too long ago had said, you know, the government doesn't owe us anything. I'm like, well, technically, if you go look at the certain treaties with certain tribes, they're fulfilling a treaty that was promised that, you know, oh, we took over this land, so we're going to pay you a certain amount because, you know, you gave us that land. That's not just, oh, this is just reparations. It is actually a treaty that was made at one point and it's still paying out. So you can look at it however you want to, whether you think we need reparations or you think the treaty needs to be fulfilled, whatever it is, there's a reason why those things are in place today.
Yeah, and I think that's where, like I said, one day, once the tribes find their language and their culture back, it's gonna, we're gonna, as people, we're gonna look back and see all the people that have passed from different tribes, and we're gonna not see them die in vain.
Right.
And that's important.
Right.
Said a lot of things that happened, and you know, we weren't born back then, but we still talk about it, and it's still used against a lot of tribes with those policies and those ideologies. And like example, the Bureau of Indian Affairs on the Crow Reservation, even though most of the employees there are Crow,
mm-hmm.
but those that philosophy, that ideology is being played out by the Crows on Crows. So to me, it's still there. Nothing's right. Really changed. It's just those policies are still there, and they still have to implement them. They still have to tax the tribe, the people, take their land, and whatever's necessary, and not really enforce why they're there. So, you know, they're supposed to be helping the Crow with education, with housing, all these things on why we lost our lands in the first place. And I think it's maybe time to start suing people again, because it's gone to be pretty bad looking at it. I think tribes have regressed. Some tribes have regressed, but a lot of tribes have become self-sufficient, and which is great. And that's what everybody wants, but it's like I said, it's really tough. It's really tough to be in those categories, because any when you start making the money, you know, people want it, especially the government.
Right. They want a piece of that. Look what happened with the Osages. The minute that people found out that there were really rich mineral rights. Yeah. Is it true that the Crow were more of a peaceful rather than a warring tribe?
No, I think we were kind of like an eye for an eye.
Right.
We, like I said, we, one of the things that, why I say that is, our Sundances, see, our Sundances were so terrifying. They were outlawed. And so now the Sundances that you see are more of the fasting and vision quests kind of Sundances. For us, it was revenge. You know, it was an eye for an eye. You killed a crow, you know, a crow would try to come
you
kill
will
you
pay.
Too. So it was an eye for an eye. Yeah. And so, like I said, we were a small tribe compared to, you know, all the tribes that are around us. I mean, I think the smallest one could have been Rocky Boy, which was at their peak. I think it was somewhere like 20,000. And our peak, we were about 30,000. But like the Blackfeet, the Cheyenne, and the Lakotas, they were ranging somewhere around 100,000 to 150,000 people before westward expansion took place. For us, when the smallpox and pneumonia took place, it pretty wiped out most of the Crow. I mean, most of our tribe, and it brought down numbers to like 3,600 or 3,700 in the early 1900s. And then, you know, it's written in the history, so it's pretty devastating.
It's rough. And were those some of those neighboring tribes, Lakota, Cheyenne, Blackfeet, Nez Perce, were those kind of the enemies of the Crow?
And like I said, our modern our allies are part of allies were the Utes, the Kiowas, the Navajo, the Pawnee, Nez Perce, the Hidatsa, Arikara, some of the Ojibwa Crees in Canada and stuff. So we were, like I said, we had our own small alliances as well.
Yeah, because I'm just learning about the Crow, I was wondering who were some of the more notable chiefs or just people in general with the Crow over the years?
Well, in history, it's probably Rod and Billy for moving. No Vitos was the one that took the tribe away from the Hidatsa, and Ron Billy was the one that had the dream to finally found the place in Bozeman area, and then sits in the middle of the land. He's the one that did the first treaty for the tribe. Actually, it was the second treaty. I don't know who the first chief was when they met Lewis and Clark at the Great Falls area, Great Falls, Montana. So I couldn't tell you that. It says in our journal, but I don't know. I never read their journals. I can't read French.
Darn it.
And then Chief Plinicu, who's our last traditional chief, but there are other chiefs as well. White Man, Chief Pretty Eagle, like all these different bands had their own chiefs, and some of the districts had their own chiefs as well. And so, and like I said, they're all kind of famous in their own way, Crow culturally, but ones that have kind of stick out with, you know, through history or including into American history are probably those chiefs. And then after Chief Plinicu died in 1924, there was no more chiefs. His his belief was that there's not going to be an honorable crow to sustain all the deeds that he did. And so, like I said, he raised the bar pretty high, and his wish was that nobody after him would be called chief. And so, so far, we haven't had a chief since then, since his
and
passing.
And that's why you were...
All we've had is chairman.
Ah, and then you were named CEO, and that was a first as well, right?
So I'm the first one that got confirmed through the tribe. It was once we established our own constitution written by the Crow people, and we threw out the constitution that the government wrote for us, the BIA wrote the constitution for us in 2000, the Crow wrote our own constitution, and that's where in the new constitution there's supposed to be a CEO, but a lot of times the CEOs didn't get confirmed by the legislature and the Senate. So I was the first one to actually be confirmed through those, through the different branches.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. And now I believe the person that followed me, none of them got confirmed yet either. So I'm not sure what's going on there.
Maybe you'll be the one and only. But I had heard the Crow were unusually tall. Is that true? And how tall were they?
Yes.
And are they?
Yes. But there was a media person that was covering the Fort Laramie Treaty in 1851. And he described sits in the middle of the land as the Indian Hercules, because he was so tall.
Oh my gosh.
He was very muscular. And the reporter said that he was about 6'6", 6'7".
Oh my Lord. Yeah, they're not kidding.
Yeah. So that was, but if you look at history, I mean, when people run, I mean, before the horses got here, I mean, when people run, I mean, even like Africa right now, example, they, a lot of those tribes still run everywhere. I mean, there's some tiny people, tiny black people.
Right.
And then there's some really, really tall black people that run.
Right.
And so, and for us, you know, we were runners before the horses got here. And so that's why I believe that we were tall. And then once the horses got here, our natural height decided to come down. And so like I said, the average height at one point, they're saying is probably 6'4", 6'3". But I heard through certain things of studies that a lot of the tribes in the plains were tall, most of them were tall. And that's why when they take pictures with agents and fur trappers and stuff like that, they have them sit down.
Is that why?
Yeah, and that's why even if you look at them, even when the Indians are sitting down, they're still about up to chest high.
That is so fascinating.
Yeah, sorry about
that. Well, then we've got the little Choctaws over here. We're pretty short people. I mean, I heard that we were taller earlier too, but
yeah, I mean, at one point before Columbus, I mean, there was buffalo everywhere, and even there was even buffalo in Florida. But everybody had buffalo, and so it kind of gives you an idea of some of the white types were so tall and some were short. But
yeah,
like I said, it has to do with running, it has to do with travel, it has to do with migrating. I think those were the effects of why crows were tall.
Interesting. Well, speaking of migrating, were the Crow nomadic plains tribes?
Yes, we were. And in winter times, we would go down to the Wind River area, Wind River, Wyoming.
Mm-hmm.
That was where our that was one of our homelands. So that was where our winter camps were. And then in the summertime, it was up to Yellowstone, from Yellowstone all the way to Billings, sometimes up to Great Falls because of the buffalo and stuff. So yeah, so we constantly moved back and forth during the winters and summers.
Yeah, got to follow the food.
Also following the buffalo. And then, yeah, exactly. And that's where, like, that's why we know where all the berries are. The June berries, where all the carrots, turnips. So, yeah, we're still pretty connected to that.
So yeah. What else would you like for us to know about your people?
Well, I would say we definitely can use all the prayers as a nation. So we have our own battles internally. We're to a point where we're finally coming out of the pandemic, the COVID. We lost a lot of elders. I think we pretty much lost a generation of elders.
Oh man.
And that really hurt. There's still a lot of hurt souls. Still a lot of grieving going on still on a reservation. And so we pray that, I know I'll ask for prayers for us to, I'm sure it's like pretty much everybody. So, you know, if you could put a prayer in for the Crow people, that'll be wonderful.
Absolutely.
That's current right now.
You've got some good listeners here that will definitely say some prayers up for y'all for sure. And we've do our sweats down in Oklahoma as well. So we'll be sure to be thinking of y'all during our sweats. And thank you for telling us about that. And I feel like another way that we can support any tribe is patroning any businesses. I noticed on the Crow website, which is www.crow-nsn.gov. There's multiple businesses such as Yellowtail Market, Crow Nation Express, Crow Hop Restaurant, Upsaliga Tours, yeah. Okabe Marina. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okabe Marina. It's also known as Bighorn Reservoir.
Okay.
And Bighorn Reservoir is almost like 80 miles long.
Ooh, beautiful.
And if you want to see a lot of crows swimming, or if you want to see a lot of Indians swimming together, during Crow Fair, a lot of the visitors go up there to go swim because the water is so cold and nice.
Right. The best time in August,
yeah.
too. So,
Yeah. You'll see people from California to New York, from North Carolina to Alaska, all swimming up there. I mean, you can finally find a parking spot during Crow Fair. And then afterwards, then they all go to the powwow together. So this is kind of
fun.
Cool.
Let's go swim and then let's go dance.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great. Let's see. We also have Crow Construction Company, Opsaloga Bison Company, and the Crow Tribe of Indian News. There's also the Crow Fairs we talked about and the Crow Native Days. It sounds like both of those are open to the public, except when you do the dance that's later in the day, right?
Yeah, the parade dance. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, everything's open. Like I said, they're the Crow Days is more of during they call it Little Bighorn Days. It's a reenactment of the Battle of the Little Bighorn.
Oh, really? Okay.
7th Cavalry and the different tribes that were in it. So they do a reenactment, and it's all good. You know, it brings a lot of tourists through there. And like I said, it's tour season right now, so it's all good.
Yeah. Battle of Little Bighorn. Is there anything you want to tell us about that, about the history of that and your people?
Well, it happened on a reservation. And so, the tribe hasn't really capitalized on that tourist. I mean, during a tourist season. Like I said, a lot of people pay like $20 or so to get into that. Mm-hmm. And I believe the last year before the pandemic, there was maybe like 350,000 visitors. And so, I mean, that's a lot of money. I mean, if you look at it, that could really help the tribe, but I don't think one penny goes back to the tribe.
Oh, really?
If I'm not mistaken.
Oh.
Yeah, from the National Park Service. Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's on our reservation. A lot of crows don't even go there. Just so you know, I never went there until I was a senior in high school. Believe it or not.
Interesting.
So even though there's something there, we hardly go in there. I guess for us, it's like, well, for me, example, like, why do I want to go see a bunch of dead people? You know, I we yeah. have a hard time with death already as culture.
Right.
And we only go to the gravesite once a year during Memorial Day, and you see all these grave headstones and stuff. So I don't think it's that fascinating,
yeah,
to tell you the truth, but it's on our reservation, and you know, we still get a lot of bad publicity about helping Custer, and but you know, history is history though, and I think like I said, those alliances that were there, the tribes that helped Custer, there's still alliances, I believe, and the ones that war against Custer, I think there's still alliances as well, and so those alliances are still there traditionally. And I'm sure that's probably like that within a lot of different areas of the tribes of
right.
the United States.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I think there were a lot of tribes that made those alliances for various reasons, and maybe we can't always judge some of those reasons.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like the tribes that helped the Confederate and then the tribes that helped the Union, you know, I'm sure they still butt heads every now and then.
And there were promises made to some of those tribes where, you know, look, Andrew Jackson turned right around and stabbed our people, the Choctaw, in the back after we helped him win a war. So, yeah, never know. I mean, again, it's easy for us to look back on history and make judgments. We weren't there. We don't know what, you know, the real reasons were about that. So, well, thank you for sharing a lot of that with us and being open.
Yeah,
and
no problem.
I love
no
learning about your tribe.
Yeah,
no,
it's even
ahead.
Better in person. It's even better in person.
I need to come to Montana. Well, actually,
yeah,
you'll have to come from Greeley, and I'll meet you in Montana.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Some things change. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
You'll be the first one I call if we get a buffalo hunt going again.
And I'm telling you, I will be there if that happens. So let me know. I'll drag my husband up there with me.
Yeah. Just so you know, our buffalo hunt was in Maxim magazine in 2003.
Wow.
June of 2003. Yeah.
Okay.
And then in 2010, Colorado PBS came with us and they filmed our buffalo hunt, but they did a documentary
what?
Called Urban Res. Yeah, Urban Res. That's Urban R-E-R-E-Z, Urban Res. And it was an hour long, and we had our a minute and 30 seconds in
nice.
That documentary. We also got a bunch of different awards through the Denver Museum of Nature and Science for our buffalo hunt, of having the best cultural event in Colorado. I think we won that award 3 times.
Congratulations.
And because of all the things and because of all the different activities I was in, I also got caught up by Colorado State University to help with their buffalo program too. So it's, you know, like I said, I've been kind of
busy.
People. Yeah.
So let us all carry on in the preservation as you've done today and are continuing to do so. But before we go, Solomon, are there any causes or businesses you'd like to promote?
I like to promote my prayers for my tribe. Like I said, we had a tough time through COVID, and we're recovering slowly, but like I said, we all could use the prayers for our nation. And then the other thing I would like to promote is if you're in high school, I want to encourage you to go to college. And I want to say our last traditional chief's famous quote, when he said, with education, you are a white man's equal. Without education, you are his victim. And it's really true. You can see the differences between people who don't have an education versus the people that have one. I think my words of wisdom is keep the faith, man. Keep the faith.
Keep
Believe
the
in
faith.
Yourself. Yeah, believe in yourself, and believe in others, and always keep smiling and keep your head up.
Absolutely. Well said. And I'll take that to heart myself. I'm eternally grateful for the good work you're doing, Solomon, and for sharing this important and precious information with us today. I believe many people will be inspired and will learn a lot about the Crow people and about some of the good things that they can do in this world, too, if they just set their mind to it. Yakuki. Yeah. Thanks for listening to Native Chalk Talk. Be sure to join our community on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And check us out at nativechalktalk.com. Stay tuned for the next episode. You're going to love it. Yakuki. Thank you, my friends.